Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the Ogletree Deacons COVID-19 podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Cutnow. I'm a partner with Ogletree Deacons in our Greenville, South Carolina office, and I'm the co-chair of the COVID-19 Litigation Practice Group. Our topic today surrounds the Family First Coronavirus Response Act, or the FFCRA, and a recent opinion out of the Southern District of New York that invalidated some of the DOL regulations related to the FFCRA. My guest speaker today is Bert Garland. Bert is a partner in the Ogletree St. Louis office, and Bert is one of our FFCRA experts, and he is going to talk to us today about the impacts of this very important decision. So, Bert, earlier this week, the Southern District of New York upended several employer-friendly limitations that the Department of Labor had put in their regulations that specifically are part of the Family First Coronavirus Response Act regulations. Just to start, can you remind our employers, what is the FFCRA?
Sure. So FFCRA was Congress's phase two response to the COVID-19 crisis. The FFCRA included, among other provisions, the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act, or as we'll call it, the EFMLEA. And the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, which we'll call the EPSLA. Importantly, under the FFCRA, employers are going to be reimbursed for the costs of all leave taken under the statute through a tax credit or similar mechanism.
That's right. And just to remind everybody, Bert, the FFCRA does not apply to all employers. So let's clarify for our listeners, what employers are potentially covered by the FFCRA?
So private employers with fewer than 500 employees and most public employers are covered by the FFCRA. For the employees to be eligible under the EFMLEA, they have to have worked for the company for 30 or more days. For the EPSLA, employees get it immediately upon hire. There are a few exceptions, Ashley, for healthcare providers and small businesses that I won't get into on this program.
That's right. And I think for today, what we really want to point out is we're talking about any government employer, small employers with less than 500, and then for our healthcare employers, we do want them to pay attention because some of the regulations that were upended by this opinion does impact them and their exception, correct?
That is absolutely correct.
All right. Well, can you break it down for me, Bert? What happened in this opinion that dealt with these FFCRA regulations?
Yes, so the court struck down the Department of Labor's regulations in four specific areas. The first is the requirement that employers actually have work available for employees in order for those employees to be eligible for leave. The second was the DOL's very broad definition of healthcare provider under its final rule. The third was the requirement that employees obtain employer approval if they wanted to use their leaves under the FFCRA intermittently, everybody's favorite subject under the FMLA, by the way. And fourth, the requirement that employees have to provide documentation to the employer prior to them taking leave.
And now this is a decision out of the federal court in the Southern District of New York. Is this opinion limited to only those employers who are in New York, or does it cover all FFCRA-covered employers nationwide?
Well, let me answer it by saying this. There are many unknowns in the wake of the court's decision. That question you just asked is the biggest unknown left in the wake of this decision.
And one of the most important ones, right?
Of course, of course.
That's right. Well, can you tell me when or how will we get some clarity on whether or not this applies to everyone nationwide or just in New York? Does it depend on what the DOL does next?
Yeah, really it does. It's not clear whether the ruling applies on a national level or just New York. Of course, New York filed its lawsuit under what's known as the Administrative Procedure Act. And that act provides for a remedy that could invoke a nationwide injunction. In this case, the court did not seek that remedy, and the court, of course, did not state whether its decision to strike those portions of the final rule applied on a nationwide basis. So in the short term, the impact on employers outside New York is really unclear, but it is going to, as you said, largely depend on what the DOL does in response. If the DOL decides to defend the current rule, it can appeal the decision to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and seek a stay of the ruling, but it has not done so to date. The DOL could also adopt a non-acquiescence stance by declaring it disagrees with the court's ruling and refusing to follow it, or perhaps they could state it will comply with the court's ruling, but in New York only. Alternatively, if the DOL decides to comply with the court's decision, it can modify its final rule accordingly. The DOL could also decide not to enforce the FFCRA against employers that relied on the final rule when deciding whether or not to deny past or current leaves. You'll remember when the FFCRA was first implemented, the DOL adopted a period of non-enforcement early on, really, I think, through the month of April, to allow employers to get their hands around the breadth and scope of the law. Although it seems unlikely, the DOL could also decide to do nothing in light of the fact that the FFCRA sunsets or expires on December 31, 2020. But again, as you indicated, the DOL has not yet issued any sort of response to the ruling or any new guidance regarding the FFCRA. So at this point, employers really should continue to closely monitor the updates and consult with legal counsel on the specific concerns.
That's right. And you know, this opinion's only been out for a few days at this point, so we are all going to have to watch this closely. But employers should definitely be aware that this is the first major decision regarding any of these regulations. So whether it has an impact binding nationwide or not, certainly other courts and judges will be looking at it if they have these issues come up before them. At least it's something that they get, even though it's not binding on them in any way.
That's exactly right. And, you know, another possibility could be that if somebody else litigates this in some other district court, another district court could issue a decision that is contrary to the decision of the court in New York. And in that circumstance, we would have a split in the circuits brewing.
That's right. And like everything else with the pandemic, I mean, you know, this thing sunsets at the end of the year, and we may not have a lot of resolution to this issue if it's going and just winding slowly through the courts. So
that's exactly right.
Let's dig into this opinion a little bit closer. So can you tell me a little bit more about the section of the order where the court attacked leave when there wasn't any work available to do?
Under the EPSLA, Congress provided 6 reasons employees could take leave under the EPSLA. The first is the employee is subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine order. The second is that the employee has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine due to concerns related to COVID-19. The third is the employee is experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 and I want to stress the word and there, is seeking a medical diagnosis from a healthcare provider, like a test, and they're awaiting the results of that diagnosis. 4, the employee is caring for an individual who's subject to a quarantine order or whose healthcare provider has advised the individual to self-quarantine. 5 is the employee is caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed or whose child care provider is unavailable because of COVID-19. That 5th one is the one that overlaps with the EFMLEA. And then 6, I won't even cover because that allows for the Department of Health and Human Services to issue some additional clarification, which has not been done yet. So the EPSLA provides those 6, really 5 reasons why employees could take leave under that act. What the court said here is that when employees are trying to take leave under the EFMLEA, as well as the EPSLA for reasons 1, 4, and 5 that I just covered, if the employer did not have available work or telework, the employees were not allowed to take leave under the EFMLEA or the EPSLA. And the DOL's rationale for that prohibition was that under those circumstances, the employee would not be able to work regardless of his or her need for leave because the employer did not have work available for the employee. And so they were not eligible for the leave. The court rejected that argument and basically said that the agency's bare bones explanation for the work availability requirement was patently deficient. And so the practical effect of this really is that employees who are unable to work or telework because of an FFCRA covered reason, those employees would be entitled to take leave when the employer does not have work available. So I think this does create a lot of potential confusion out there. The court did not address whether unavailability of work requirement is permissible in a temporary layoff or furlough situation. But I think the answer to that really is going to turn on whether the individual is still considered to be an employee. So I think how the employee was temporarily laid off or furloughed is really going to be determinative of whether they're entitled to the leave.
That's right. And certainly with the number of layoffs that we saw from March until today, that's a really important question that we do need some clarity on from the DOL moving forward as to how they're going to view that requirement. And also with the PPP loans running out, we could see another wave of temporary or permanent layoffs. So it's a really important question to get answered.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to the next part that the court did not like with the DOL regulations. What about this definition of healthcare provider? What did the court say about that and the exception that healthcare providers were using with the FFCRA?
So the court said quite a bit about this one, so get ready. So under the FFCRA, Congress permitted employers to exclude healthcare providers from the leave benefits under the EFMLEA and the EPSLA. The Families First Act incorporated the existing FMLA definition of a healthcare provider, but also allowed the Secretary of Labor to issue regulations further defining who was a healthcare provider for purposes of the FFCRA. And the DOL did so. DOL very broadly defined who was a healthcare provider under the FFCRA. The court basically held that the definition adopted by the DOL under its final rule was way overbroad. The court noted that the DOL even conceded that an English professor, librarian, or cafeteria manager at a university with a medical school would all be considered healthcare providers under the rule. The court went on to further state that the rule that the DOL adopted was way overbroad, and the court basically said it, the DOL improperly focused on the employer's identity rather than the employee's job duties when it defined healthcare provider to include employees whose roles bear no nexus whatsoever to the provisions of healthcare services except the identity of their employers. So basically, all hospital workers were considered to be healthcare providers by the DOL under the FFCRA, and the court said that that was way too broad. So again, the practical effect of the court's decision is that it requires employers really to follow the FMLA's existing definition of a healthcare provider, which is very limited compared to the definition adopted by the DOL for purposes of the FFCRA. I know it's a little tedious. I will define that to include basically doctors, podiatrists, dentists, clinical psychologists, optometrists, chiropractors, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, clinical social workers, physician's assistants, Christian Science practitioners, or other healthcare providers who practice in a country other than the United States who are authorized to practice in accordance with the laws of that country. So the definition in the existing FMLA, according to this court, is what applies, not the definition adopted by the DOL for purposes of the FFCRA.
And of course, any of the healthcare providers who are listening need to really pay attention to this as they move forward. And of course, talk to their legal counsel about this change in the definition to decide whether or not the FFCRA is applicable to one of their employees who may or may not need some leave. So Bert, now let's move on to, you know, one of the favorite subjects in all of the FMLA, which is intermittent leave. So what did the court say about intermittent leave as it applies in the FFCRA context?
Well, the DOL in their final rule and in their Q&A guidance that they've put out on the DOL's website, they made it very clear that intermittent leave under the FFCRA was available only with the employer's consent. And the New York court basically struck that provision down. The court said that employer approval is no longer required when an employee takes certain leave intermittently. For example, when a child's school is closed or childcare is otherwise unavailable, the employee may take leave under the EFMLEA and the EPSLA on an intermittent basis without prior approval from the employer. And of course, that one's coming into the forefront these days as schools are looking to ramp up in one form or another, either all online, a hybrid of online and in-person, or all in-person. And so these laws are really coming to the forefront again. And basically what the court said here is that if let's say, for example, there's a hybrid learning where the child is allowed to go to school 3 days a week, but must stay home 2 days a week. The parent under this court's decision would be entitled to take that leave intermittently on those days when the child is not permitted to be in school and the employee does not need the employer's consent for that leave. Another example would be if an employee is teleworking, the employee may take leave under the EPSLA on an intermittent basis for illness-related reasons. And the reason they can take it on an intermittent basis is because there's no risk, if they're already teleworking, there's no risk that they're going to expose others in the workplace. So they can take that leave intermittently without employer approval.
And you know, Bert, this one really hits home for me personally. I am in one of those school districts where we are doing the hybrid learning. So I have three kids, and in my house, we are on the red team. And what that means is that my kids could go 0 days a week, they could only go on Mondays, or they could go on Mondays and on Wednesdays. And my school district is only going to give us notice of what they're doing about a week in advance for the next week. So I'm not going to have much notice as to what kind of leave someone in my school district may need because of this hybrid schedule we're going to, which brings us to our next question, which is, you know, in my kind of school district or one similar to me, what did the court say about what kind of documentation is needed prior to taking a leave?
Under the DOL's final rule, the DOL had said that the employer could mandate that employees have to provide documentation prior to the employee taking leave. And what the court said there is that that requirement was basically too broad. It was inconsistent with the Families First Act and, quote, cannot stand, end quote. So the practical effect of that one is that employers can only require employees to submit documentation before they take leave if the need for leave is foreseeable. But when the leave is not foreseeable, and Ashley, it sounds like in your situation, you're not going to have much notice there. When the leave is not foreseeable, and that would include a situation where an employee is ill, the employee may provide documentation after actually commencing the leave.
That's right. Or as soon as you know. So in my case, it would be as soon as we get notice from the school district that Friday before for the next week, then we would give notice. But of course, that's not giving employers much time to be nimble. So people are really going to have to be flexible in these kinds of situations.
Intermittent leave and notice issues are some of the hardest issues under the FMLA anyway. And under the Families First Act, they are now going to be very difficult for employers to manage under this decision.
Now, Bart, let me ask you this question. For employers who relied on the DOL regulations that have now been thrown out or attacked in this opinion, is there liability for employers who are relying on the DOL's regulations when they made their decisions?
That's a great question, and the answer is we're really not sure yet. We're going to have to review each specific situation and see what the DOL's response is before we can make that determination. One other thing I'll add in there is that, of course, Congress right now is debating its phase four response to the COVID crisis, and there is certainly going to be some sort of employer liability shield in that law. We just don't know how broad or expansive that liability shield will be. But I, for one, am hopeful that the liability shield that's included would protect employers from liability based on this court's decision or potentially other subsequent decisions by other courts.
That's right. And, you know, and I think it's important as people are thinking about the implications of this moving forward to remind everybody that if you do have to give these paid leaves, that tax credits are available through the FFCRA to help fund them. And, you know, Bert, I know one question that I've gotten is, let's say that someone forgot about the tax credit or needs to amend it. How long do employers have to amend their tax filings to address these FFCRA tax credits?
Ashley, I've got a guy for that. I don't wade into the tax issues very much. I know Mike Mahoney in our firm is the expert on that one. So I would respectfully defer to Mike on that issue.
That's right. But I think it is important for employers to know that they do have a period of time to amend their tax returns to be able to address these credits if they need to do so. If they didn't get their tax credits in correctly, they do have a period of time to be able to amend those credits to be able to take them and get some money from the government to help pay for these leaves, which was the original intent of the FFCRA. So, Bert, I can't thank you enough for jumping on our podcast today and giving us a wonderful insight into this new opinion and into its impacts. And of course, Ogletree will be following as we see what the DOL does in response to this opinion and any other opinions that come out that are similar to or going in an opposite direction as this opinion does. So again, thank you so much for listening today, and we hope you'll join us on our next podcast.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.